Ghost Hunting in New England,
your favorite spooky podcast. Hello and happy Wednesday. Welcome to Ghost Hunting in New England. I'm your host, Amelia. And today we are going to do something very, very interesting because I'm here in studio with Allison and Dan from the Fairbanks House over in Dedham, Massachusetts. So welcome, you guys. Thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having
us. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
So let's get started. Now, this is an extremely old property, correct? Well, hold on. First of all, what is at the extremely old property? What is your positions there?
So I am the program coordinator. I do educational programming for all ages. I do a lot of kids programming, but really for everybody, historically themed activities and stuff like that.
Cool.
And I'm the curator. The easiest way to explain what I do is I take care of everything and I know what everything is.
Perfect. So you are the best people to talk to, I guess, then.
Like to think so.
So I had known nothing about this house. I didn't know it existed. I mean, history is not always my best thing. I'm interested in it, but I'm not like a buff. However, my cousin Beth, who everyone listening knows, she is. And she had us go to a lecture that you gave at the Norwood Library on the house. And it was fascinating. And we had a wonderful time. And it ended. And we looked at each other and we were like, we have to get them on the show. So if you guys could just start by telling us a little bit of the history of the house. So it was built at 1647?
37. 1637.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. The house was built in 1637 for Jonathan and Grace Fairbanks, who were a couple that came here from Yorkshire, England. And they actually brought six children and two indentured servants with them from England. As was rare back in the day, all of them survived. And so the house went through eight generations of the Fairbanks family. The last person moved out in 1904, a woman named Rebecca Fairbanks. So the house was lived in for 267 years, all by one family. And actually, the family does still own the house today. They're the ones who own and operate the museum.
Well, and part of that is, you know, you had said you had never heard of it. And that's actually one of the things we're working to change, because it isn't super well known in the historic community. And part of that is because it is still owned by the family, which has amazing upsides to it. Because, again, it's been in the family this whole time. We have artifacts dating from, you know, I mean, it's incredible. It's been a museum longer than most houses have existed even. But because the first, you know, 7-8 decades of it being a museum, it was basically just run by whatever family member wanted to look after it. It wasn't run as a professional museum. It used to kind of be like, this is the family homestead that people are allowed to come look at if they want. But it's only recently that it's really, this is a public museum, even if it is owned by a private genealogical society, which is, it is a public nonprofit. So, I mean, that's part of why we're trying to get more people aware of it, because what I don't think has been mentioned yet is that this is the oldest wooden structure still standing in all of North America.
Which is amazing.
Right. And so, I mean, people think like, oh, you know, yeah, no, there must be older stuff. Like, no, that's nothing confirmed to be older than 1637. And by confirmed, I mean, dendrochronology was done, which is tree ring dating. So they literally could take core of the center beam, the summer beam of the house, and actually tell exactly what year the tree was felled.
Wow.
And yeah, back then they used green wood, so it would have been built the same time the tree was felled. And so that's why we know for a fact it was 1637. Yeah.
It has been scientifically confirmed that it was built in 1637.
If you've ever been to the house, a lot of people are confused. It says 1636 on the chimney because the family thought it was 1636 because that's what year Jonathan was deeded the land. There's a bunch of other houses. I'm not going to name names, but there's a couple I know specifically who also claim to be 1636. And they say, oh, you know, yeah, we're also those. But in terms of tree ring dating of science, ours was proven to be 1637. And these couple other houses are from the houses themselves are the 1650s, 1670s at the earliest. It's all, everyone used to just go off of, you know, oh, well, when were you due to the property? And we were tied with a lot of other people. But then science came along and proved us the oldest, which we're very proud of.
Yes. And how has it survived so long?
Yeah, I always like to say there's three things that have kept the house standing this long. It was incredibly well built to begin with. Family didn't try to build it themselves. They are professionals right from the beginning. The family has, from a very early age, understood what they had and wanted to protect it. And third, and probably most importantly, blind luck. There has never been a major fire. There's never been a tree falling over onto the house during a hurricane. Even when the family had misfortunes in the mid-1800s, they hit a rough patch and they were fairly poor. At least the branch of the family still living in the house was. And the 1800s, of course, are what most people refer to as the Victorian era. And Victorians were into bigger, better, newer, fancier. Who cares if it's old or historic? Tear it down, build a nicer one. So while everyone else was doing that, the Fairbanks still living in the house could just afford to maintain what they already had. You know, even when bad things happened to the family, they ended up, in the long run, having a silver lining.
Well, so, I mean, it was terrible for people who lived there in the 18 and early 1900s, but it was so fortunate for us because, as Gam was saying, the Victorians ruined everything. When it comes to history, the Victorians ruined everything. So any other houses that are first period houses, meaning mid-1600s, have been updated. So during the Victorian era or more recently, they have had lots of changes made because of new technologies like plumbing and electricity, and also because of like building codes. But the Fairbanks House became a museum in 1904. So already that was before a lot of the things that would change a lot of houses. So the Victorians, the people living there in the Victorian era, couldn't afford to change it. And then it became a museum before it would have undergone a lot of other changes. So the house has never had heat, electricity, plumbing. It is still in the same condition and look that it was in 1801, which is amazing and makes it incredibly unique, because even other houses that are close to that old have been far more modernized.
Yeah,
that's unbelievable.
Yeah, and one other thing about the house that's really amazing. So most historic houses, when the family moves out, they take their stuff with them, and whoever comes in to make it a museum later has to find things to furnish the house. When the last Fairbanks, again, Rebecca, moved out, she just took a couple of prized possessions with her and left the house as is.
Wow.
So everything that is in the house, or most of what's in the house today, has been there since family actually lived in the house. Some of it dating all the way back to the 1600s, the majority of it from the late 1700s to early 1800s.
And of course, that ties in with a lot of what we're going to be talking about tonight, because certainly people think ghosts or spirits can be attached to a place. They could also be attached to objects. So we have objects that have always belonged to members of the Fairbanks family that have been in this house for centuries. So, I mean, it's pretty much prime ground for historical and paranormal activity, basically.
Normally we offer, you know, regular, you know, historic tours, and then in the fall we have special tours just about the ghosts. But one thing I say on the ghost tours is, you know, it's a house that was lived in for 267 years, and that was all before hospitals. Everyone except the first generation was born in that house, and everybody except the last generation died in that house. And, you know, 8 generations. So if there's any place that's haunted, it's going to be that one.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's incredible. I really liked the story about when you first realized it was kind of haunted. Do you guys want to talk about that?
Yeah.
So sure. I guess the first thing to mention is that Dan and I are married, and we live on site.
Yes.
So the Fairbanks House, the museum, well, it's never been modernized, in 1912, on the same property, literally 10 feet away from the museum, a Sears and Roebuck kit house was put up. And that has been fully modernized, fortunately, with electricity and plumbing and everything.
And
central air. But upstairs is the museum offices, and the first floor is our apartment. So we do live on site at the museum. And the only electricity in the museum was a little bit was wired in there just for the security system.
Yeah.
Just, you know, because insurance-wise, and there had to be security. So there are motion sensors in the house, but the panel that controls them is in our apartment. Because the whole point of the Sears and Roebuck kit house being built was to have someone to be able to monitor the museum at all times.
Mm-hmm.
Dan's always been a believer. I was unsure. I was like a believer, but also I didn't want to be a believer because it scared the bejesus out of me. So I was like, no, I'm sure things don't exist. It's fine. And when Dan first got the job, everyone told us, you know, oh, yeah, no, there's nothing here.
Yeah. So when I was applying for the job, you know, I got an interview and they're showing me around the house. And I specifically asked, so the 400-year-old house, almost 400-year-old house, any ghosts? And they're like, no, it's no ghosts, no ghosts, no ghosts anywhere. As I said, okay, that's actually kind of weird with a house this old, but all right.
And Dan has experience. He used to give ghost tours in Boston.
Yeah, so I've done this stuff before.
He had a history in it.
Yeah. And that part of why I thought to ask. And so I thought it was weird that there's no awning, sure, in a 400-year house, nothing. And then I accept the job, and we move in. And within the first 2 weeks, everybody I talked to was like, hey, let me tell you about the ghosts. I was like, what? You said there weren't any. I guess they were worried about scaring us off. But again, I have experience with this. Allison was a little less sure about it after we heard about it.
It was a good thing they didn't tell me till after we had already paid the moving company.
So, yeah.
Right. I wouldn't have been as...
A little more hesitant, at least. So anyway, we're about 2 weeks in. We're still settling in. I'm still getting the hang of the job. We're still getting the hang of the house. People have been telling all these stories. And so one night, we're getting ready for bed. It's a little late. It's like 1 a.m. We're about to go to sleep. And we're talking about maybe not the best choice of topic for this time of night, but
But this was the first time we had been talking about it. So people had been telling him stories at work. Yeah. He was telling me. So this is the first time since we lived in the house that we were discussing paranormal activity in the museum.
Right. And so I'm relaying all these stories to her, and I get to one that was told to me by the prior curator, that apparently the ghosts in the house can set off those motion alarms if they want to. And as I'm telling her about this, the motion alarm goes off. And
for the first time since we moved in.
Yeah, so this is the first time we've even heard it. And of course, again, the panel's there and so is the alarm in our apartment. And so I go over and check, and it says it was a second story room. No external alarms, no first floor alarms, just a second story room.
So in other words, there's alarm. If any doors or windows had been opened, that would have been a separate alarm.
Yeah.
This was literally just saying there's movement in the room upstairs.
Yeah, with no, other movement. Yeah. And so, again, I'm still new there and I'm still not sure what to do. So I turn off the alarm. I look out the window and I don't see anything happening. And I turn it back on. And it doesn't go off again. And I decide, you know what? It's probably fine. I'll check in the morning.
For like half an hour, we're like, we should probably go check, right? But like, it's like 1:30. Like, no, don't go out there. This is how all the horror movies start.
Yeah, right?
Do not go at 1:30 in the morning to check out the mysterious, like.
Yeah, so what really got me interested in looking into this further and eventually led to the ghost tours was that alarm would go off roughly once every week or two, always between 1 and 3 a.m. And it stopped about a week after I gave the first ghost tour.
And it's worth noting, the motion sensors are about knee height.
Yeah, the lowest ones are knee height.
A chipmunk, a squirrel could not have set this off. Yeah, wouldn't have set it off. It would have to be an animal big enough that we would see signs of a huge animal. Not to mention the fact that animals don't keep a schedule. Like, you're going to have a raccoon.
Yeah, it wouldn't always be between 1 and 3,
This raccoon always comes through at 2:30 in the morning. Like, no, that doesn't... So there's no way it was an animal setting off the motion alarm every time. Because a lot of people say, oh, I'm sure it was just, a squirrel. But it wouldn't work that way.
Yeah. Yeah, the timing of it and the positioning, wouldn't happen that way. The alarm doesn't go off on us anymore, except, so we're only open May through October, because as we said, there's no heat or electricity. You do not want a tour of the Fairbanks house in January. So we're only open half the year. And so, but I have no problem, we have no problems with the alarms until April, when it's been 5 or 6 months since I've talked about any Fairbanks, the alarm will go off. And actually, I think last year I actually went into the house and like just said out loud, I know I haven't talked about you in a while. We're opening soon. I'll talk about you again. Please stop setting off the alarm. And it stopped going off again.
That's awesome.
So that's the 1 to 3 a.m. alarm. I will say the alarm has gone off a couple other times. There's been, once or twice in 3.5 years of living there that maybe it was just like a glitch or something. Mm-hmm. But the majority, if it's not between 1 and 3 a.m., there's been several other times the alarm has gone off. And it's almost always when we haven't been home all day. Because we get, it doesn't seem to go off. Unless it's between 1 and 3 a.m., it doesn't go off while we're just sitting around at home. We get a call from the security company saying, the alarm is going off. Is everything okay? And it's always after we haven't been around for a whole day or if we're on vacation. We go away to visit his family and, we haven't been home in several days. And we have to call, one of the board members who lives nearby and say, can you go check it out? And everything's always fine. But the ghosts... they get a little antsy, not only if you haven't been talking about them, but also if they feel like there's no one there to be watching the house. They say, you're out, hey, pay attention. You need to be looking after the house better.
Well, that's something I tell people who look nervous about taking the ghost tour. Some people just hear it's haunted and don't want to take even the regular tour. But I tell them our ghosts are friendly. Nobody's ever been hurt or attacked. They're just here to watch over the house. And as long as we tell their story and we protect the house, we're good. we have sort of an accord with the ghosts. That
yeah, I mean, there's been so many paranormal experiences from guests, from board members, from staff, but never anything malevolent. Never anything, you know, harmful.
No one's ever been hurt. There's one room in the house where you get a sense that, like, they don't want you in there. But it's never, like, they don't push you. It's just sort of a, like, more of a gentle, like, you should leave now. Not a, like, out.
Yeah, well, it's never anything physical. But we just have people who are more sensitive. You know, we've had mediums come in. They just generally, in that part of the house in the West Wing, will get a feeling of sadness or just kind of like a, oh, just leave me alone. You know, so again, when Dan's saying being pushed away, it's not physical. It's just some more sensitive people feel like there's a presence in the West Wing that just wants to be left alone, basically.
Somebody who doesn't want you there, but isn't willing to do anything physical about it.
But we keep talking about the wing. So there's the central part of the house that was built in 1637. There's the West Wing, which was built in the early 1700s.
Well, somewhere between the late 1600s and early 1700s, then heavily modified around 1800.
Rebuilt or whatever. And then the East Wing was built in the late 1700s. So they're very different, you know, architectural styles in each of the wings, but they are all connected. But just, I figured we should explain that because we keep talking about the different wings.
Yeah.
But again, this presence in the West Wing is, it's never harmed anyone. And it's just a sense of kind of sometimes someone there's gets a little crabby.
Yep. Sad and wants to be left alone. But that's only in the West Wing. People, again, sensitives, mediums get a sense of sort of, they're usually somebody fairly friendly and even like matronly kind of feeling, like a somebody who just wants to watch over the house and make sure we're doing the right thing. That's the rest of the house. And then the West Wing has the sad ghost, I guess.
They feel like children, family in the East Wing. So the main part of the house, matronly, East Wing, there's more of a feeling of family.
Okay. So when the alarms started going off, is that when you called in the mediums and different parts? Because I know you guys also have had a ton of paranormal ghosts going in.
Yeah.
To the point where I actually, Barry Corbett, who's the lead investigator for Boston Paranormal Investigators, he found out because we had posted online that we were at your talk, and he sent me a note saying that he had gone and he had investigated, and it's very haunted, and it's an absolutely interesting, interesting location.
Yeah, his group's been at our house twice.
Yeah, and then they're great people.
Oh, yeah.
No, I work with them a lot. They're fantastic.
They're really good. They're really good. Actually, the most recent investigation was last month. I know they found a couple of things. I still need to talk to them more about what they found, but I know they found it got a couple of EVPs.
Ooh.
Well, to answer the question more specifically about whether we called in mediums right away. So I think first, when that first happened, we were kind of like, ooh, you know, and at first it was like, oh, was this a one-time thing? But then when the alarm kept going off at that time of night, the first thing we did was talk to board members and the previous curator about, like, okay, so clearly you guys weren't, you know, filling us in all the details, want to tell us now. And so they were telling us more things, and we found out that the previous curator had some mediums in, and had even actually, she had it gotten bad enough, again, not with, you know, harmful things, but just with her being bothered. That she actually had someone come in to do like a psychic cleansing. But even the person who went through and cleansed the house said, there are a couple spirits here that are so strong.
Like they don't want to leave.
They don't want to leave. I can't make them.
So I guess according to that medium, there was a native presence elsewhere on the property, like not in the house, but on the property. And those, they were able to move along. But the ones in the house didn't want to go. They were happy there.
They were like, this has been ours for 400 years.
Yeah, exactly. We're here for a reason. You're not going to get us to leave.
Yeah.
Though I have to wonder about whatever the native presence they felt, because one of the more recent paranormal investigators found evidence of figures outside and like sitting cross-legged on the ground and being in like in the, you know, so maybe they're back.
Yeah, maybe. Wow. To go back a little. So actually, at least one ghost hunting group had come in before I got there. Two. So they actually brought in Taps, guys from Ghost Hunters. And I don't know if you've talked about this on your show before, the way they do it specifically. They send in like a B team first. The B team does an investigation. If they like what they find, then they send in the crew you're familiar with on the TV show and the cameras. So they did the B team thing. They were like, yeah, this place is haunted. You guys want to do an episode here? We can. All you have to do is sign away all the rights to everything. You get nothing out of this except exposure on our TV show. Mm. And we get everything. And so the prior curator was like, no, all set.
Well, and there's also the Fairbanks house has been burned a couple times by TV crews. Like someone, they came in to do a pilot episode for
HBO
a show.
HBO did a pilot episode
and
there. And
they did far more damage than they paid to do the show. Like it was just.
Yeah, repairing the damage costs more than the amount of money they got for the filming. So they're like, we just don't want to do this anymore. The other group that the prior curator brought in was a group called Spirits of New England, and they did a very good job and got some really amazing stuff, and I brought them back in. They were the first group that I brought back in, and then with, you know, Bill Corbett and Boston Paranormal, and another group we've been working with a lot is called Moonlight Investigations, but we've also had several other groups. We even had a pair of Irish ghost hunters come check out the house.
Cool.
They moved a couple of things without asking, though, so that's not okay. But otherwise, otherwise, we've had a lot of different groups, and pretty much all anybody who's gone to investigate that house has found something. So that's when I always say on the ghost tour. If you go on a ghost tour and they promise you'll see a ghost, they're selling you something, right? Yeah. But when people go in to investigate and do it properly, they will probably get something. Hmm. It's just a very active location.
So you have EVPs, you have video, I believe there are some photographs. Mm-hmm. So what was your reaction the first time you saw, let's say a video of something? Were you just like, oh, that makes sense? Or were you like, relieved that these suspicions were confirmed? Were you?
Yeah, I would say it was a little bit, that makes sense, but also kind of we're not crazy. We're not imagining the alarm going off or just seeing patterns where nothing exists. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, I'd say when I first showed up, I was only kind of a believer. I mean, I'm completely 100% a believer now, absolutely. Yeah. What I tell people often is that any individual piece of evidence, whatever it is, can be explained away by coincidence, by science, whatever. But how many coincidences do there have to be in the same place before it's just too coincidental? Yeah. And that's kind of what any one piece of evidence, I can say, oh, well, that could be explained by this. That could have been because of this. But there's so many that I like seeing new pieces of evidence because it just helps me feel, justified. Mm. And it's also just exciting because people are really into this. People love to hear about it.
My favorite example, and the one that really just blew me away, and I'm fairly certain I played it at the talk you were at. But anyway, it was captured by Spirits of New England, and it's they sent one of their lighter people into a room that isn't usually gone into because it's the floor is less than fully stable. And 400-year-old house, it happens.
Yeah.
The parts of the house open for the tours are all completely stable.
Yeah, if the tour goes there, the floor is stable. This room is usually cordoned off. So they picked the lightest person in the group, had him go in by himself. And since no one ever goes in there, it was a little dusty. He kicked up some dust. He sneezed. And he had a high-gain microphone going for EVPs. And so he sneezes. And then when they listen back, you hear the sneeze. And then you hear a woman's voice clear as day say, bless you. And it's incredible because it's a man by himself in that room. And it's very clearly a woman's voice responds, bless you.
You did play that. And it was incredible. Yeah, that was a really good one.
And actually, the people from Spirits of New England told me later that that is the clearest EVP they've captured anywhere in their entire career ghost hunting. That is the most clear, perfect EVP they've ever caught.
That's awesome.
And so that one really struck me. And then the other thing that struck me is the video that the same group got of shadow figures in the East Wing, because it's two very distinct small, fast-moving figures followed by a much slower, larger, much larger figure. And it sort of invokes sort of a sense of kids running along followed by a parent, really incredible. And
and the East Wing is the same
wing
where...
That's the family wing, yeah.
Yes, people who are sensitive to these types of things always say mm-hmm. they sense kids, they hear kids laughing, mm-hmm. Things like that, more family-oriented stuff.
Yeah, the other groups have come through, have also produced some just amazing stuff. And every time I hear something new or see something new, it just, it just adds to the picture.
Incredible. To the amazement of it.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's not just, vindication that, hey, we're right. It's also just this is amazing. It's so incredible. Another amazing technology that's quite new in the paranormal investigation scene that Moonlight Investigations has been using is it has to do with the technology actually started with the Xbox Kinect, where basically if you have a Kinect, it scans you and it kind of creates a digital stick figure of you. And you could see that on the screen. And that's how it knows where your arms are moving and how your body moves. And so paranormal investigators have now started using this technology, or some of them have, to see if that technology will find stick figures where there aren't any people.
Mm-hmm. And well, it started with people playing Xbox, and their Xbox would be like, there's two people in the room. And they're like, no, there aren't. And so people started wondering, like, what is it picking up? And then the ghost hunters took it and ran with it.
And they've got some really dramatic ones. I mean, there's some where it's like, okay, there's, a coat rack in the room. Clearly, mm-hmm. that's what the Kinect is right. seeing as a person. But I mean, so many of these, it's like the technology doesn't see anything.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, like the background of like the whole room will change, and all of a sudden there's a figure there. It's very dramatic and very clearly not just a mistaken piece of furniture.
Yes. Yeah. And I look at, obviously, because what I do, a mm-hmm. lot of ghost videos, lot of them. And I had never heard of the Xbox Kinect until, I'm not a gamer, so I didn't even know it was a thing at all. But I definitely didn't know it was a thing to have to do with ghost hunting until I went to your talk. And I was so struck. So you guys have one where it's a video of a room, and all of a sudden in the bassinet, a very small stick figure shows up, and it's like, oh my
God. Laying in the cradle. Oh, and this is upstairs in the East Wing. Which is, the family part of the house. And it's very, the stick figure moves the way it looks like a baby would move. It's the size of a baby. It's very clearly in the bassinet. Nothing is there. All of a sudden it's there. And the way this technology works is it kind of, even when it doesn't make stick figures, it kind of, maps the background area. And it wasn't mapping anything. And then all of a sudden this stick figure shows up, and the entire room had this blue background light. I mean, the energy of the room changed. You could see it in the video, evidence of the energy changing and this stick figure moving around in the bassinet, and then it was gone. But the thing is, most videos of stuff you get like that, it's for 5 seconds, maybe 10 seconds.
Yeah.
This is like a full, what is it?
Over 40, a minute.
Almost a minute, if not over a minute.
No, I think it's over a minute.
I mean, a long enough time that this is not just a technology glitch.
That's incredible.
And there was actually another one they got. They were in the part of the house called the lean-to, which is sort of a workshop area built off the back of the original house. And they got a figure standing at a table. And the figure was there for almost 5 minutes.
Wow.
And the guy holding the camera started shaking because he was so cold. And it was middle of summer when they got this. He got so cold spot, he got so cold his hands started shaking. Everything they recorded that night came out perfectly except that 5 minutes, which was completely corrupted. So they managed to record it, watch it once. When they went back to their, office to process everything, it just had corrupted completely and they couldn't salvage it at all. So you have, but it was, they told me about it that night and I saw a bit of it. It was there. They had it. But when they went to recover it, it was gone.
And that's pretty common. Yeah. When you have your most amazing evidence.
Yeah.
Is what they'll corrupt.
Yeah. Well, and also the entities at the Fairbanks house, one of their main ways of showing themselves is by draining technology.
Yeah.
So that's the second or third time that film or evidence has been, strangely corrupted with no other, issues in the technology or anything. But also they're keeping problems with many of the groups who come in and saying, I had 3 fully charged battery packs, but I gotta go because everything has been drained. Mm-hmm. So that's a very common one at the Fairbanks house is strange.
Yeah, there's another fellow that is fairly well known around here, Anthony Duda. But anyway, he's been at the house a few times now, and one time he brought all these neat gadgets that he was looking forward to trying out. He had charged all of them the day before. 10 minutes in, everything's dead. Literally everything you brought with them.
Wow.
So, except the basic stuff. The audio recorder still worked, the camera still worked, but all of his, little gadgets and stuff all just died. Our ghosts are picky. There are certain technologies they're okay with.
Yeah.
But if you bring in this weird stuff, they're going to turn it off on you.
Right.
Which I think is really interesting. Of course, that suggests a different, like, awareness of their surroundings. Whoever is there, like, knows they're a ghost.
Yeah.
is the impression I get.
It's an intelligent haunt.
It's not residual at all.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And I will say also with using the Kinect technology, I mentioned earlier about that we saw figures outside. That was how we saw them.
Yeah,
that outside there was a figure sitting on the ground and one in the garden who then appeared to dive into the ground. Like the stick figure is there, it dives and then disappears. I think that was the only group that's done anything outside on the grounds of the Fairbanks house. And the person who was doing it is of Native descent. Hmm. And so I wonder if they were responding
to her specifically.
Well, yeah. I mean, because honestly, I would understand that if they are native spirits, I wouldn't want to talk to colonizers. I mean,
it's like, you know, all these white people wandering around, probably waiting for a Native American to, waiting for a Native American to interact with rather than, you know.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. Who do you guys think the spirits in the house are? Do you have names for them?
Yeah, we have a pretty good idea. So the main spirit, the sort of matronly protective one, is likely, we think, Rebecca, that last tenant.
I'm almost positive.
Yeah, we're pretty sure it's Rebecca. I don't want to assume anything, but we're pretty sure it's Rebecca.
Well, just aside from the way the spirit behaves, we also know Rebecca did not want to leave. Yeah. In 1904, so before that, she had money troubles. And because, again, that the last century of people living in the house had struggled. And Rebecca did not want to leave. And basically, so funds were raised to keep the house. And she was told, you can keep living here as long as you give tours to anyone who shows up. So this poor woman is in her 80s. This is her house she's lived in for decades. And suddenly she has to show it to people, you know. So anyway, I mean, there's so many great stories about Rebecca. We could do a whole thing about her. But she was not a fan of that. And it was funny because the family would take out, like, ads in the local paper apologizing for how rude Rebecca was. Basically, like, we're sorry about that.
Yeah, at least twice they didn't. Yeah.
But starting in 1902, the family was like, oh, Rebecca, isn't it time for you to, you know, why don't you go move in with your sister? And, you know, it'll be much more comfortable for you. And she's like, nope. She would not leave until in 1904, her dog died. And this hound was her beloved companion. You can't find a picture of her without the dog. Mm. And that's when she finally said, okay. And so the only reason she finally agreed to leave was because her loyal companion wasn't there anymore. Mm-hmm. The family had started legal eviction proceedings to try to get her out by that point.
Oh, my goodness.
Because they kept trying and she wouldn't leave. So she did not want to leave. She passed away in 1908. And I think she came right back.
Yeah, we're pretty sure she
didn't
want to
leave.
Yeah.
We know she didn't want to leave in life. Why would she have left in death?
So, yeah, we're pretty sure Rebecca's the sort of the main entity. Well, another thing that supports that is, so I mentioned cold spots. The most common form of cold spot in the house is roughly knee height brushing up against people's legs.
And there is an EVP of a dog whining.
Yeah, and there's an EVP of the dog whining. So, yeah, she's not alone. It's her and her dog are both there together. Watching over the house.
And that was actually, after the alarm stuff, that was my first experience personally in the house, was a cold spot. And it was one of those, I mean, it felt like my hand had been dipped in ice water. I mean, it was so dramatic. And we were nowhere near anywhere there could have been a draft, not to mention the fact that it was mid-August. So it was incredibly hot out. And I mean, I literally could move my hand in and out of this one spot. And then it faded away and wasn't there anymore. But it was, you know, with my hand down at my side, exactly the height of a large hound. So that was my first, you know, personal experience aside from just hearing the alarm going off.
And then the West Wing, we've narrowed it down to, I mean, one or two of two guys. Around 1800, when the family's fortunes are starting to go downhill, you have two Fairbanks that have a pretty rough go of it, Jason Fairbanks and his brother Abner Fairbanks. And so at that point, the house was owned by a guy named Ebenezer Fairbanks Jr., and he's the one who added the East Wing. So it's him and his eight children and his wife that are the family activity over there in the East Wing.
Oh, my goodness.
But the West Wing is his two younger brothers, we think, whereas where his two younger brothers live, Jason and Abner. And so Jason is sort of the black sheep of the Fairbanks family. In 1801, he was tried, convicted, and hanged for murdering his girlfriend. There is still debate over whether he actually did it, or if he did do it, was he mentally fit to stand trial or to understand what he had done. He had a lot of, to make it a very long story short, he had a lot of issues. Mm. He had a lot of problems, many of them not in any way his or the family's fault, but he definitely had those issues. And a young woman did die while he was the only one in the area, as far as anyone knows. So anyway, and I know Allison's been researching Jason a lot, and I can see she's really wants to interject here.
I'm not gonna say much just because, you know, we don't have several hours for me but I've been researching this, and just he allegedly murdered his girlfriend Elizabeth Fales, but he was hanged for it, and it was a huge event in Denham. The Jason Fairbanks murder trial was the O.J. Simpson trial of the early 1800s. I mean, this was national news. This was crazy. Yeah. He was broken out of prison, and there was a nationwide manhunt. I mean, it's a very dramatic tale. Well, but so clearly he had a rough go of it at the end.
Yeah, he had a rough go of it. Actually, to give you one thing to note that really puts this in perspective, at the time of his hanging, 2,000 people lived in Dedham. 10,000 people showed up to watch Jason's hanging.
Oh, wow.
It's the best attended event in Dedham history to that point.
Oh, my goodness.
And actually, since there's no major performance venues in Dedham, it might still be the best attended event in Dedham history.
I was just
going to
say that. Yeah. I was going to say outside of their Flag Day celebrations.
Right. That might be the best turnout they've ever had. So anyway, he had a very rough life that was made very public. But his brother had a very rough life that was made very, very private. Abner was 4 years older than Jason. I can tell you that his name is Abner. I can tell you his birth date and his death date and literally nothing else.
And that is incredibly rare.
Yeah.
I mean,
by that point, people had records.
Because the house was always owned by the Fairbanks family, we have great records. And there were local physicians in town who kept detailed records. And I mean, literally, we know so much about every Fairbanks who lived in the house except Abner.
Yeah. Hmm. And so the feeling is... this is sort of where, like, the paranormal and, you know, history and medical history and all the weird stuff sort of come together, which as a historian, that's the part I always look for. So Abner was definitely an interesting aspect of the Fairbanks family for me. We think what happened, again, this is all, well, it's an educated guess, but
educated speculation,
that it looked like Abner had some sort of severe illness that in early 1800s, with little or no medical knowledge, would have looked something like possession.
Epilepsy or some sort of...
Yeah, epilepsy or any kind of movement disorder, anything like that. If you don't know how human physiology works or germ theory or any of that, it's pretty easy to come to the possession conclusion. And so based on a few different things, we think that may have been what happened to Abner.
Well, I think it's worth saying, so some of the reasons that we think this, and this kind of, again, connects with the paranormal aspect, is that so hex marks are something that are, you know, very common in first period houses. And the Fairbanks house has one of the largest and most varied collection of hex marks of any first period house in this area or in
anywhere in the country. Yeah, there's a lot of them.
So clearly, and many of them we can date to the late 1700s.
And just for our listeners who might not know what hex marks are, could you guys explain them really quick?
So a hex mark is – the most common forms are either a cross or a circle or what are called daisy wheels or pinwheels are very common. But the thought was that a hex mark did for your house spiritually what windows and doors do for it physically. They were wards or protective. The technical term is apotropaic markings. That's kind of a mouthful. So anyway, hex marks are ways of protecting your house from evil spirits, witches, demons, all this stuff that in the 1600s, when the house was really built, people full on believed these were real things. You know, the devil is real and he actively wants you, yes, you, to go to turn evil. And he is going to do everything in his power, and his minions are going to do everything in their power to turn you or hurt you in some way. So anyway, the hex marks from the 1600s were for that.
And of course, hex marks in general, there's a whole other, you know, 3 hour long talk we could give weird intersection of the religious intolerance of Puritans and their use of folk magic, but that's a whole other thing.
On the surface, Puritans were against this. Under the surface, almost every Puritan household had some hex mark somewhere.
So, I mean, these hex marks are all over the house, but there is a crazy concentration of them in the West Wing.
Yeah.
And again, just based on who was living in the house at the time, the teenage slash, you know, young 20-something males would have been the most likely to have had their bedrooms be in the West Wing at this time, and that would be Jason and Abner. And another thing, so aside from the large variety of hex marks, there's the nail in the floor.
Yeah. So. Oh, yeah. So the nails throughout the house are iron, all of them, except one. There is one brass nail driven into the middle of the floor in the hall, in the hallway of the West Wing. It's the only brass nail in the entire house. So I saw that and I was like, that's got to be something. So I looked and I dug, and after a lot of effort, I found out that it was something similar to the hex marks, in that they thought that a nail did the same thing spiritually that it does physically, holds things in place. So if you have a family member who has a fit or seizure or whatever you want to call it, what you do is you wait for them to collapse and you watch where their head hits the floor. And then you drive a nail into the, preferably a brass nail, into the floor where their head connected. And that will pin the seizure or fit or epilepsy or whatever it is to the ground, hopefully curing them.
Mm-hmm.
And this was part of the same belief structure that created hex marks and all these other kind of folk magics.
So you've got that. And then possibly the most dramatic is that the West Wing is also the only place in the house where there is evidence of locks on the outside of the doors.
Yeah.
As in someone or something being locked in their room.
Yeah, so a bedroom with a lock on the outside of the door is suspicious no matter what time period, you know.
Or, oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and what else is going on? So something bad was happening with somebody.
Could be, of course, a lot of the things we're talking about with Abner could also have been one of Abner's aunts who, you know, it said died of a palsy, which back then meant literally died of any sort of movement disorder they couldn't describe otherwise.
Yeah.
So we don't know for sure it's him, but there's definitely little enough information about him and enough information about something weird going on in the house at that time to draw some conclusions.
Yeah.
Jason, the idea that it might be him is pretty much just because of the whole star-crossed lovers, you know, love cut short thing. Because even before, you know, when he and Elizabeth first got together, her parents didn't approve of him and all this and that. So there's a very dramatic story. But according to the family and the records, no one knew of anything really wrong with him, at least mentally. Physically, he had some issues. But there's nothing in the house to suggest that anyone was worried about Jason, pretty much. So it's in terms of who had a more dramatic, mysterious past, that would probably be Abner. But in terms of who died the most dramatically, that would be Jason.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're pulled to them.
Yeah, so it could be either of them or both of them that's in the West Wing.
And we do know that someone in the West Wing really likes weddings. People will sometimes rent out the field at the Fairbanks house for a wedding reception, at least to have photos taken, because, you know, it's beautiful. So on one occasion, a couple of people were standing outside the house, you know, staff members, and they were watching, you know, these people having pictures taken, and they see one of the curtains in the West Wing move aside as if someone's peering out. Another time, there was a wedding, and a docent, a volunteer, was going around closing all the shades for the day, and they went to close this same window in the West Wing, looking out over the field. A voice says, leave it open.
A man's voice, specifically, said, leave them open.
So they did. But so that's another reason why that might suggest Jason, just because part of his and Elizabeth's story is that he wanted to run away and elope with her because her parents didn't approve of him. And there's a question of, did she refuse him and he murdered her, or did she try to go away with him and something else happened? And so there's a lot of, but that would suggest Jason also.
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting. Very interesting.
So it was interesting when you kind of cross the history and the paranormal aspects, and, you know, sort of in the history field, you're not allowed to use spectral evidence.
Yeah.
But you can use history evidence in the ghost hunting field. So,
oh, for sure.
In fact, you should. So but it's interesting to kind of, because we know so much about who lived in that house, we can do this more than a lot of haunted places, where we can actually, you know, a lot of places like, oh, there's a ghost. People see a lady in a dress. Okay, well, there's a lot of different ladies in dresses. But, like, at least at the Fairbanks house, there's ways to narrow it down more specifically than in most places, which I think is makes it even more interesting to me.
Well, and because, like we said, the main part of the house was built in 1637. But the fact that other parts of the house were built at different times means that we can get very specific about who lived where when.
Yeah.
You know, because we know for a fact that the last men to live in the house were that generation. So basically the West Wing hadn't been built that long before the Jason and Abner generation. And after that generation, the family's fortunes go way downhill, partly because Ebenezer Jr., who's Jason and Abner's brother, didn't make great money decisions, but mostly because of the murder trial of Jason, the family reputation goes down the toilet and they can't, you know, no one will sell them or anything. So after that, it's only unmarried women who live in the house until 1904. So we know that there aren't any later guys in the West Wing. So it's nice because we can pinpoint things like that.
So yeah, we get a male presence in the West Wing. It can only be so many people. Yeah.
That's fascinating. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, I will say for anyone who's interested in, you know, in the ghost tours. So this year they were only on Fridays and Saturdays in September and October, but they're coming back next fall, certainly. We're not sure of the schedule yet, but certainly on weekends in the fall. The museum itself is open for regular tours in the daytime Wednesday through Sunday, starting May 1st. It's open May through October. So if people are interested in coming to visit. So the ghost tours and things like this have brought a lot of attention to the paranormal aspects of the Fairbanks house, which I think is great because it is so wrapped up in the history and because it's really great for getting, you know, more attention and more exposure for the house. But it does have some interesting challenges because, for instance, we have a lot of public school kids who come to the house for field trips. And now that the ghost tour has been around for long enough, everyone's heard about them. So now every single group of third graders who come through, oh, is this house haunted? Is there ghosts? Are we going to see ghosts? Are we going to see zombies? Oh, something moved in the window. I think it's a zombie. Mm. You know, so it's...
There's zombies, children. Yeah, there are no zombies.
There's no zombies.
I was just going to say, because we have a lot of kids who listen to this show, and can you confirm zombies at this point?
We cannot.
We confirm there have been no zombie sightings at the Fairbanks house.
Yeah. No.
Ghosts
no,
only.
No zombies, no mummies.
No vampires. But ghosts. Yeah. And again, they're friendly ghosts.
That's about, and even, you know, most of the experiences people have are sound based or feeling based. You know, people will see, in terms of sight, people see orbs. A few people have seen, you know, a face, or, you know, someone was working on a glass display case and they saw a reflection of someone and then turned around and there was no one there. Mm-hmm. But there's not a lot of visual evidence, which is another reason why the whole thing with the Kinect technology is so interesting, because it's a way to visual evidence.
Yeah.
But the majority of the evidence is sound and feel based.
Yeah.
Cool. And so I guess everyone listening should go check out the Fairbanks house, because apparently that's what keeps the alarms at bay.
Yes.
As long as we keep telling their story, they won't set off the alarm on us in the middle of the night.
And I just think that's so fascinating. And even, I mean, I obviously love a good ghost tour, but even just the general history of the house, I mean, that's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, something so old, it's incredible.
So uniquely unchanged.
Yeah.
Because like I said, even anything even sort of even close to that old is just not in this way that this is unmodified and unchanged. And it's a really unique site for knowing about colonial history, colonial architecture. Yeah. And I mean, the more people who know about it, the better, because it's a treasure that a lot of people aren't aware
especially of. Especially in Dedham, Massachusetts, which I feel even in the last like 10, 15 years has gone through so many changes itself as a town and as a community.
Absolutely.
To have this like amazing piece of history there is incredible.
It really is. For many years, the Fairbanks House was sort of, you know, it's its own thing. And we've been trying to work with the town of Dedham, with the Dedham Historical Society, Dedham Library, and more, which is part of why I was at the Norwood Library giving the talk that you saw us at. So, you know, just kind of getting the word out there in whatever way we can, because, you know, for years we've been, you know, people who are interested in early colonial history and people who are interested in the history of architecture have always known about the house. It's like, okay, how do we get everybody else to know we're there?
Right.
And so this is all part of that.
Really. It's very, very cool. Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Unrelated to the house.
Okay.
This is just really for me. Our listeners, I hope you like it, but it's for me and it's for a few people who work for me, because I have a few people from Dedham who work for me. Why is Flag Day such a big deal in Dedham?
We have no idea.
Okay.
I think I heard one person postulated that it was it's just because the other towns around Dedham have all taken, like, the 4th is big in this town and Memorial Day is big here, and nobody had taken Flag Day yet.
So for people,
and that's it, I think.
For people listening who are not from Massachusetts,
it's a really big deal.
Flag Day, which is the June 14th, is a massive day in Dedham, Massachusetts. They have a parade.
And a big parade where we get, like, I mean, we have, you know, we had, you know, sailors from the Constitution and, like, you know, nation-renowned, you know, bands and I mean, bigger names than you would think for Flag Day parade.
Yeah, and I think it's the only parade Dedham has in the entire year. They don't have any, like, no Thanksgiving Day parade, no Christmas.
No memorial. Fourth of July.
They just have Flag Day.
No, it's just, and it's a huge deal.
That was the one theory I heard put forth, was that, like, it was the, yeah, one day they weren't competing with any of the other towns for their parade. Yeah.
It's one of those, so no one really talks about why. Everyone just talks about, oh, next Flag Day. I think a couple of years ago, it was the 50th Flag Day celebration anniversary or something. So they've been doing it for a while.
Oh, yeah.
I wish I had a better reason for you, because I know every Flag Day, I'm like, why?
You know what?
But it's nice for us because the parade begins and ends at Dedham Middle School, which is literally across the intersection from the Fairbanks house.
Oh, very cool.
So we get to, you know, see the beginning and end of it.
Yeah, we can just sit on the stone wall next to the house and watch it.
But yeah, sorry, we can't be more specific because
we don't know either.
You know what? Sitting across from historians, I kind of like that answer. Yeah, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes even we don't know.
It's so silly.
Yeah.
Well, cool. So if people want to get in touch with you guys and learn more about the house, what's your website? What's the contact info?
Fairbankshouse.org. And there is a contact form on the website as well as our email addresses.
But so for Daniel, it's curatordaniel@fairbankshouse.org. And for me, it's programs with an S, programs@fairbankshouse.org. People who are in the area, definitely keep an eye on our website and on our Facebook page, because we are doing a lot of programming. This is still pretty new for the Fairbanks House, but this past summer we did some, you know, stories and s'mores, or we told stories around our, you know, we have a fire pit on the opposite side of the property from the 400-year-old wooden house, of course. Yeah. But we, you know, make s'mores and tell stories. We did a cheese and butter making class. At the end of September, we have a fall festival with reenactors and hard cider and spirits and vendors and all sorts of good stuff. And if people are interested, Dan is giving the same ghost talk you went to. Dan is giving again at the Morrill Library in Norwood on December 2nd. So if you're interested in that, contact them. I don't know. I know you need to reserve a space. I don't know.
Yeah, the first one sold out, and so they actually called back everybody who was on the wait list to do it again.
I will say that is very true. First of all, it was a great talk, and everyone listening, you should go, and we will throw that event up on our social media so you guys can find it there. Sure. But Beth had called me like the day before, and she's like, hey, we're really going, right? Because the library just called us, because there's like a huge wait list for this event. And I was like, yeah, we'll be there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was big, and you should go. It was very interesting, and you'll learn even more than you heard tonight. So that is December 2nd.
And February 3rd, Dan is at the same library giving a talk about how to build a house that lasts 400 years. So basically your question from the beginning of, you know, why this house is still standing, he's giving a whole talk about that. Cool. If anyone's more interested in the historic or architecture side than the paranormal side, which is weird that you're listening to a, you know, ghost podcast if you're not into the paranormal stuff, but, you know, no judgment, whatever. <Yeah. laughs>
Well, that's awesome. And thank you guys so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Very perfect. And we will keep in touch.
Definitely.
If possible, if you guys want to send us any of your spooky videos, we'll throw those up on our stuff so people can kind of go and see and link up. And this was awesome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Wow, thank you so much, Allison and Dan. That was interesting. That was super interesting. Super spooky, too. So everyone, if you're local, please go make sure to go hear their talks. And in the summertime, go and look around. It's a cool spot. I can't wait to. Now it's time for Drive-By Ghostings, the section of the show every week where we read your ghost stories back to you. So here we go.
We gotta call the aquarium or something, dude.
Did that sound clip sound familiar? Yes, it's true. We got follow-up from Mike from Arizona, formerly from Massachusetts. Here we go. For part two, here's a quick one. After my dorm at UMass, I moved into my first apartment in Sunderland, Mass. According to my internet research, the house was built in 1835. The downstairs occupant was the office of the lawyer who owned the property. I believe the house was the old preacher's home, but I have no real proof of that. The house is right across the street from the town's first Congregationalist church, which itself dates back to 1717. This is old New England. This house had some bona fide bad mojo, if not truly bad. The spirit, or spirits here, were cranky. I only lived in the house for about 6 months, but that was because of money, not the haunting. But the summer I lived there, I experienced some things. The job I had while I was living there was doing closing shifts at the Cumberland Farms up the road. I would get home around 12:30, 1 a.m. each night. My roommate had a little studio up in the attic. The attic light would almost always be on, and half of the time he wasn't home or hadn't been up there all day. The attic was one of those spaces I'd go into and the hairs would stand on end. It would feel like someone was staring me down as I went back down the stairs. After a while, I stopped turning off the light or going in the attic altogether. One day when I first moved in, I was unpacked and sorting through boxes. Of course, I was playing CDs on the stereo while working. I was listening to a band called Controlled Bleeding, grating metal industrial. I would bring something upstairs, come back, and the CD was off. Cue up the song I was at, keep working, go upstairs, come down, off. This happened like 5 times before I changed CDs to one by Low. Indie fans will appreciate the abrupt juxtaposition of styles. So did whatever was stopping the other CD. The player worked just fine after that. Often, at odd hours, like 2 a.m. on a Sunday, we would hear someone stomping around the lawyer's library, which was directly below our kitchen. I mostly thought our landlord was down there furiously doing case prep at off hours. Turns out it was never him. My bedroom in that house had 2 doors. One went to a hallway that the other bedrooms all had doors to, and the other went into the kitchen. The door to the kitchen was just planks, kind of rustic, like a shed door. It had old-fashioned bar and never latch that never really worked in a hook-and-eye lock that actually kept the door closed and locked. One wall of the room was the outer wall of the house, and the fourth wall separated my bedroom from the living room. The kitchen and living room were super creaky. No way could someone walk around the apartment without being heard. One night, after coming home from being out drinking beers around a campfire, I climbed into bed and promptly passed out. But as the kitchen door never latched, I made sure to use the eye hook. I was barely starting to dream when something slammed the kitchen door hard. I woke up, startled out of inebriation. I laid there a while, expecting to hear creaking tiptoes through the room. My roommate just messing with me. Quiet. I laid a bit longer. Quiet. Finally, freaked out, I got up to make sure someone hadn't followed me. I grabbed my flashlight and shone at the door. The latch eye was knocked open. I went to the kitchen. Nothing. I checked the door from the outside. Locked. I checked around the apartment. I was home alone. That was a great story, Mike. Thank you. Good story. That one was really spooky. I liked that one a lot. Ooh. Okay. And so, now it is time for our next story. And you know what that sound clip means. It is now time for another ghost story. Told to us by Jen from Maine. So here we go.
Hi, my name is Jen, and this story happened to me about 5 years ago. I was in my bedroom, was falling asleep, and I started noticing that in a certain corner of my room, there would be this dark shape, this dark, darker than dark. The only way I can explain it is my room was dark, but the figure was darker. And it was crouching in the corner. And I know that image sounds very frightening, but it didn't feel threatening. I was afraid because that's strange, but it didn't feel like a menacing presence. So I started noticing this sometimes at night when I was falling asleep. And then I started feeling the edge of my bed being bumped, like as if someone was standing there and sort of nudged it with their hip slightly. And that would happen every so often. And it started to bother me. And then one night I was falling asleep, but I was still awake. So I was laying on my stomach in my bed under the blankets, and I felt something jump on my back, and it felt like a cat. So I hopped up and turned the light on, expecting to find my cat in the room, which would have been unusual anyway, because my cats are never in my room at night, and I keep my door shut. And so I jump up and I turn on the light, ready to yell at my cat for sneaking into my room, and there's no cat. There's nothing. But I felt it, and I know it was real. And so fast forward a couple of months, and I am visiting with a psychic, and she was fantastic. She told me a lot of things, and she knew a lot of things that no one could possibly just guess. Anyway, I asked her about the if my house had ghosts in it, and she said yes, but that they were protective spirits and that I shouldn't be afraid. And so I started to tell her the story about when I felt something jump on me, and she interrupted me and said, "Like a cat on your back," which just floored me. I mean, how did she know that specific description? And I said, "Yes, exactly that." And so she said, "If they bother you, talk to them like you would a normal person and say, 'Please stop, I'm trying to sleep.'" And so the next time I felt my bed get nudged, I said that right out loud. I said, "Please stop. Please stop bothering me. I'm trying to sleep." And it stopped, and it never happened again. So that's my story. Thanks for listening.
Good story, Jen. That was awesome. I love that. Spooky kitty. I like it a lot. And yes, that's very true. If you feel like ghosts are bugging you, just tell them to bug off. Say, "Get out of here, you." Sometimes it works. Doesn't work. Call someone like me. We'll come investigate. So, that is it this week for Drive-By Ghostings. I would like to remind everyone to get your Drive-By Ghosting on next week's episode. Please have them in to me by Thursday at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Now it is on to 5-star reviews. So this week, we got one review with a comment, and it was from Super Watch. And it says, "This podcast is the best for local New England lore and spooky stories. Many mind-opening topics are also discussed and are very rewarding to listen to. I work at home most days all by myself, but I never feel alone when ghost hunting in New England is on. Once you listen, you won't want to miss a single episode." Well, thank you so much, Super Watts. That was a really encouraging message to get. And not only that, I would like to give you an extra special shout out because you sent that in on Saturday. And I was having a very bad day Saturday, and I'm sitting at home on my couch watching Dr. Phil, having a pity party for one, and I got that message and I just felt great. So thank you so much for sending it. Really made my day way better. And yeah, we are very, very close to hitting 55 star reviews. We're only 3 reviews away. So if you would be so kind and please go on the Apple iTunes store and leave the show a 5-star review, that would be so appreciated. That would be so cool. Make everyone so happy. Oh man, we get to reach more people, hear more ghost stories. Are you serious? That'd be incredible. If you do not feel the show deserves 5 stars, however, please feel free to send a private message through any of our social medias, email, or through our website, letting me know what I could do to make the show a little bit better. Well, that's it, guys. I am so excited. I have some really cool stuff that I just booked up for you guys for the month of December. really interesting interviews we're going to have with people. I am just so thrilled. As always, I have so much fun doing this. Thank you all so, so much for listening. I look forward to being here with you guys again next week. So, as always, thank you so much to Aaron Schild for doing all of our music. You can find him online on Instagram at TheAaronSchild. You can contact us through email, ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com, on Instagram at ghosthuntinginnewengland, on Facebook, facebook.com/ghosthuntinginnewengland. Follow us on Twitter, ghosthuntingne. Please give us a follow on Twitter, and feel free to also retweet our stuff, because we could really use some more Twitter followers. Also, you can always reach us online, ghosthuntinginnewengland.com, or by carrier pigeon at the Somerville Media Center in beautiful, sunny Somerville, Massachusetts. We would also like to extend a huge congratulations, extreme warm wishes, way to go, unbelievable, to our friends over at the Unbelievers podcast, who just celebrated their 1-year anniversary of their show. Way to go. That's so awesome. They're so much fun. And if you guys haven't had a chance to go check them out yet, please go do so at the Unbelievers podcast. All right. Well, that's all I have for you guys tonight. Be sure to always tip your barista. And as always, happy hunting.